Welcome to the Maria Heller Show, the Internet's original podcast. Since the year 2000, always ahead of the curve, always on your side. A true warrior for truth and justice, Maria and her guests leave nothing out, and no one is off limits. There is only one truth, the rest is lies. Sit back, enjoy the education with a true daughter of Mother Earth. Sharp New York wit, spiritual knowing, and a very dry sense of humor, Maria will dissect the news and lies to make it all palatable. Education is power. Maria delivers rapid-fire truth like no one else can. Here she is, the mouth that roars, the legendary Maria Heller.
Good morning, world. Welcome to the Maria Heller Show. And here I am, Maria Heller, alive and kicking. Today I have an exquisite interview for you. I don't know how else to say it. I have read this book from cover to cover. And my guest is John Potash. The book is called Drugs as Weapons Against Us, The CIA's Murderous Targeting of SDS, Panthers, Hendrix, Lennon, Cobain, Tupac, and other activists. Now, you'll remember John because he's been on the show before. The other show is still in the archives here. Let me tell you a little bit about him. He's completed graduate studies at Columbia University. His first book, which is also excellent, The FBI War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders in 2007. You've seen him on C-SPAN's American History TV. You've read about him in a lot of different magazines. And he's also worked counseling people with mental illness and addictions for over 25 years. So let me say good morning to John. Good morning, John.
Hey, Maria. It's good to be with you again.
It's always good to have you back. God knows, I guess it was 2007 when you were on the show last.
Yeah, sometime around then.
I have to tell you this, and I know that you refer to Dave McGowan's work in your book. I think that this book is the perfect companion to Dave's book, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon. It's like it takes it to the next level.
Thanks a lot. I love Dave's work, so I appreciate you saying that. Actually, I just finished Program to Kill, and that was really excellent.
Well, yeah, you know, I've been interviewing Dave, God, since I did terrestrial radio. So, you know, he's a total void out there, that's for sure. And I miss him every single day. But this book kind of takes it into the groups and the singers and the activists after the people that Dave talks about in Laurel Canyon. So I think the two of them go together so well. You know, when I was a young girl growing up, there were a lot of things that I just intuitively knew, okay? And I looked at a lot of the hippies, I looked at the yippies, I lived through, you know, Timothy Leary, you know, tune in, tune out, drop out, etc. And intuitively, I just knew to stay away from these people. You know, there was no proof at the time that Timothy Leary was, you know, pretty much working with the CIA. I looked at the hippies and I knew it was not a movement I wanted to get involved with. And then I looked at, you know, what the Black Panthers went through in this country. And for whatever reason, people today still think they were terrible people, but they were actually pretty damn good and really did accomplish a lot before the government decided to put them in their line of fire. John, what made you decide to write a second book, you know, basically continuing on with after the first book on Tupac?
Yeah, well, this was actually Drugs as Weapons Against Us was actually the first book I was writing. The Tupac book was more of a tangent from Drugs as Weapons Against Us. But I was originally writing Drugs as Weapons Against Us as a novel. I had written some short stories that I just read out loud in Baltimore, and someone heard me and published it locally, and people liked it a lot locally, you know, in Baltimore. And so I was writing this political novel when I came across what was going on with Tupac Shakur and thought, well, nobody's going to, you know, I thought very few people were going to be interested in a new, you know, novelist who they've never heard of. So let me write about someone who they have heard of, and that's, you know, something that hasn't been said before, which was, you know, finding all this research about that Tupac Shakur was actually a, you know, serious political activist who was taken down by COINTELPRO, and nobody was writing about at the time. And So I published something first in the spring of 95, and then an article, and then Covert Action Quarterly. Finally published it in winter of 1998-1999. And so that, when I got that out, then people close to him encouraged me, to turn into a full-length book, because they said no one else was getting this stuff out there. And it was also a way to tell everyone about the full history of the Black Panthers and radical Black movements that just weren't getting out in mainstream media, but also not even in the leftist magazines to the full extent that I thought they should be. But, particularly a new generation of people weren't as interested. They kind of heard the story of the Panthers, but they weren't as interested anymore. But through Tupac Shakur's life and times, they were interested. And thankfully, people have told me, that are my age and older have said, well, my kids won't listen to me when I try to tell them about the Black Panthers and radical Black history. But when I gave them your book, they read it because they love Tupac. And so I'm really thankful of that. So I had that idea about these other great musicians, about John Lennon, Jimi Hendrix, and Kurt Cobain, thinking that, okay, if you marry their left-wing politics, which they all were into, with the activists that aren't as beloved as them, you can get people, different generations interested in this other version of history that, is kind of censored by mainstream media and what's really going on. And at the same time, warn them about how drugs were used as weapons against these great musician activists and these other great activists, from, Paul Robeson to Robert F. Kennedy and, of course, people like Fred Hampton and believe it or not, even people like Rolling Stones, Brian Jones, who was turning one to activism. So you got all these histories intertwined, and I just, I kind of put them and the musicians in the spotlight because they really hit our kind of hearts and minds at the same time, because we're so passionate about music, a lot of us. And so this is, what I hope to achieve with this.
Well, you obviously did achieve it, because I can tell you, once I started the book, I didn't bother putting it down, and I always take my books with me to the gym. So when I'm doing my cardio for an hour, I can read the books. And people are always asking me, what are you reading now? Which is a great, segue to talk to them about what's gone on, what's still going on. Hey, listen, and I'm always looking for an opportunity to talk to people constantly. So, a book is as good as a t-shirt. Sometimes a t-shirt can start a whole conversation.
Right.
I wasn't too surprised, though, when you talked about Elvis Presley, because a lot of people seem to have, in a way, forgotten about him.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always felt that he was targeted. Because mm-hmm. of his popularity. I mean, men and women loved him the same. And I always thought that Colonel Parker there was his handler. And when people say, what did Elvis Presley die of? And to me, I see his doctors with their overprescription more like handlers, very similar to what happened to Michael Jackson.
Yeah, I could see similarities. Now, I didn't research Michael Jackson, but I can see that similarity, especially since Michael Jackson was getting more political.
Right. Yeah. Well, when people talk to me about Michael Jackson and they want to believe the hype that the media threw at him to hit him where it hurt him the most with, accusations of he's a child mm-hmm. molester, he's this and that. When he died, my kids, who are, at the time, maybe 30 and 40, they were surprised that I was upset that Michael Jackson died, because they thought Michael Jackson belonged to their generation. And I said, listen, Michael Jackson was, I was 10 years old when Michael started his career. And of course, I had watched him, but I intuitively knew when he came out with, I think it started for him, when he came out with his black and white video.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, this kid's going to get targeted. Okay. And I remember that video, all these years later. And then he started moving into environmental videos. His song, Earth Song, which is an amazing video. They Don't Really Care About Us, the one he shot in the prison. You listen to the words, and then all of a sudden, you know, he's dead, and as the doctor that killed him gets 4 years in jail.
Yeah, and that tour, his last tour, was supposed to have some very political stuff at his concerts, and it was, you know, sold out tour all over the world. I mean, it was, you know, going to be a huge tour. And so, anyway, yeah, I agree with you. I didn't research Michael Jackson a lot, but I do get asked about him, so I had to look into it a little bit, of course, and it does seem to fit the pattern. And that pattern is that they seem to, now, the only thing about Michael Jackson is he, you know, granted, he died of some kind of drugs that he was on, but he didn't fit the pattern in the sense that most of the people in my book seem to be manipulated by U.S. intelligence to first get into the drugs, and then so they're manipulated to promote the drugs, but then when they try to sober up and get more into left-wing activism, they get done away with.
Right.
And that generally fits the pattern of the four guys, you know, in the center of the, you know, my cover, Kurt Cobain, Tupac Shakur, Jimi Hendrix, and John Lennon. But it also fits with people like the Rolling Stones, you know, in terms of Brian Jones, because Brian Jones got manipulated to get into the drugs. And then when he started sobering up and asked John Lennon and Jimi Hendrix to join him in a super group, and they were all, you know, seriously political against the war. This comes from A.E. Hotchner's book. A.E. Hotchner was a longtime editor for Ernest Hemingway, and his excellent book called Blown Away about the Rolling Stones talks about this at length. And he said that, you know, there were several witnesses to the fact that he was murdered, and, you know, he was drowned in his own swimming pool, and the fact that he had been sobering up and, you know, had actually contacted Jimi Hendrix, his friend Jimi Hendrix, and his friend John Lennon, and they had tentatively agreed to form the supergroup. So this was the pattern. And before that, Hotchner said, in 1965, this Robert Lashbrook brought over, you know, tons of acid and loads of money and agents, and telling these agents to get acid in as many musicians' hands as possible. And that was part of MKUltra. And that was, MKUltra was the use of drugs as weapons against us. And if you look in their documents, MKUltra documents that I include pictures of in the book, you can see it says, you know, use of drugs as unconventional warfare. And when U.S. intelligence is, you know, practicing unconventional warfare, it's not just abroad, you know, on a battlefield in some foreign country. They consider dissidents in the United States part of that warfare. Now, there's a war abroad, there's a war at home against people that oppose that war. And that's what, you know, MKUltra was doing. It was targeting dissidents abroad. I mean, targeting dissidents both abroad and at home.
You know? Right, right. Well, you know, I thought about that. And I think when I got to that part in your book, I kind of put the book down and I started thinking, you know, here we are, you know, it's 2016. We've been in war for 14 years. There is no anti-war movement. I'm sure MKUltra is still, you know, somehow still behind the scenes. But I thought about it and I said, well, why aren't they still doing this now? And then I really thought long and hard on it, John. And I said, well, they don't have to today because they're drugging us in our water, in our air, in our food, in vaccines, in big pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. So they have drugged us down as a country because it's the only explanation I could come up with, that we have no anti-war movement, that people are just sitting back, letting an election be stolen in front of them. So much anger in the country, so much violence in the country. And a lot of these drugs and, you know, include a lot of heavy metals, a lot of neurotoxins. And I think that today they don't really need to secretly drug us because they're drugging us every which way we turn. I mean, what do you think of that? Do you think I'm freaking out there or making more of it than
I agree. For the most part, I agree with you, except for the fact that I think there is still an anti-war movement. It's just that the media has gotten so monopolized. Mainstream media has gotten so monopolized. You know, when you look at Ben Bagdikian's book, you know, The Media Monopoly, I mean, you know, he was a former dean of Berkeley School of Journalism, and he had to keep revising his book, The Media Monopoly, because it just kept getting more and more consolidated. It went from, you know, his first book, first edition of The Media Monopoly started with some 12 or 16 companies that owned 95% of the media. And with each edition of his book, it kept dwindling down to from 16 to 12 to 10 or 8 to now, you know, his final version I saw that could have gotten worse is there's six multinational corporations that own 95% of the media, of mainstream media, and control, basically, he says, you know, he shows, controls 95% of our information. And that's, what we're dealing with. And so there, I think there are a lot of anti-war sentiments, a lot of anti-war activism, but it's so concealed, where it's concealed from each other. You know, our sentiments are concealed from each other in terms of being anti-war. And, any kind of activism is just kind of, not given a limelight, not given a spotlight at all.
Right.
And so there's little protests here, little protests there. I'll hear about some protests in Baltimore City that, I've made one or two, and I haven't made a lot of others. But when I try to see if it's covered anywhere else, it isn't, and I bet this is happening in cities all over the country that, okay, there's protests and there's people that want to protest, but they're just not finding out about each other. So it looks like there's no protest at all and, no anti-war sentiment at all.
Well, yeah, it seems the only place you'll see any of that is going to be on social media.
Yeah. And the other thing, though, is that, I do feel like, I researched this book up until I started coming out with it, and I still was finding examples of the way drugs were used as weapons against us. For example, when you saw that chapter on the Occupy movement.
Right.
And the Occupy movement started in, 2011 or 12 or so. So, I think it is actually, MKUltra is alive and well, just either using different names, as, M. Wuzzy swearing and said about COINTELPRO, the FBI's counterintelligence program. He said, they pretended to close it down in 1971, but they just actually continued it with different names.
Well, I'm certainly not surprised over that. I did want to ask you, what did you think of the fact that so many people turned on Beyonce after her political statement at the Super Bowl?
Yeah, it was like barely, it was not a big political statement, but it was just even having that, what she had with the, wearing the Black Panther attire and all that. Of course, people jumped down her throat, like, how could you do that? This is horrible. When, really what happened with Beyonce doing that probably is the grassroots, so many grassroots activists saying, calling, for example, a friend of mine, Fred Hampton Jr., he's just a great activist. His father was an incredible leader of the Black Panthers, Fred Hampton, a Chicago Black Panther leader. But Fred Hampton Jr. is a great activist who talks nationally, too. And he calls Jay-Z Slave Z, and because he thinks he's just sold out completely to corporate media. And so it's people like him and so many other great activists pressuring Jay-Z to do something more activist, to not be so sold out to the corporations. And so, of course, Jay-Z gets his wife, Beyonce, possibly, I guess, or maybe Beyonce just wanted to do it herself because she's got the, wanted to pay tribute to the Black Panthers. And good for her that she did it finally, that she made some kind of political statement. It's not in-depth political statement, it's just clothing, but good for her to even do that because it raises awareness.
Right, yeah. But you know what? They don't make the same flap when white actors make political statements at the Academy Award.
Yeah, right. White actors could be saying, racist stuff here or there, or even blurry racism, here or there, but it's not necessarily such a flap as, wearing Black Panther outfit,
I thought her outfit was quite similar to the one that Michael Jackson wore.
True, yeah.
So it's like, what's the big deal, right. I think Fred Hampton Jr., I don't remember because it was so long ago, but I remember interviewing, I think it was him, and they had a music group at the time. And I know he was the son. They were all, a couple of them were sons of the original Black Panthers. And I had them on my show. God, it had to be 16 years ago. So there's no way I even remember it clearly. But I remember that it was a great show. One thing I'd like to, if you don't mind, John, I'd like to just read a little bit out of your book. Because, listen, I was a very huge Elvis fan. Okay, I'm one of the few people that actually got to see him alive. And your book kind of gave me confirmation on what I just intuitively always seemed to have known. But you talked about how Elvis was pretty much Elvis until he went into the service. And once he went into the service, and it says here in your book, biographers say Colonel Tom Parker started giving Elvis pills before he was drafted. and controlled Elvis for the rest of his drug-shortened life. And you talked about an interview where they had asked John Lennon about Elvis. And John Lennon said Elvis died when he went into the army. That's when they killed him. That's when they castrated him. The rest of it was just a living death. But when you look at, I get to the next page and I'm like, wow, okay. After Elvis died, and they try to say, of course, it was a heart attack. He was only 42, by the way. Within months, two lab reports said that polypharmacy was heavily implicated. Elvis's doctor, George Nikopoulos, had written prescriptions for 10,000 doses of amphetamine, sedatives, and narcotics for Elvis for the 8 months before he died. 10,000 doses. Holy frijoly, Batman.
Yeah.
And you say, how do these people not go to jail?
And for people that don't understand why I would consider Elvis somewhat of an activist, look, I defer to John Trudell, former head of the American Indian Movement, who burned a flag on the I think it was the Pentagon steps or the I'm sorry, I think it was the Congress's steps in a protest on behalf of the American Indian Movement. And after he did that, his house burned down and he lost his wife, his mother, and kids all in that house. They all burned to death. And I think that's not a coincidence. And he retired as an activist after that. He was so distraught and became a singer. And then Jackson Browne produced an album of his called The Graffiti Man. And on that album was a song called Baby Che, for Baby Che Guevara. And that song was about Elvis. He called Elvis Baby Che because he said Elvis was the first person that liberated men's emotions. When he first heard Elvis on the radio, he felt like Elvis was a revolutionary for liberating him to be emotional and to be open with his emotions. And so Trudell says that, and others have said that Elvis broke all the barriers of segregation and would constantly say, "No, I'm not the king of rock and roll." People like my friends like Bo Diddley and all these great black musicians were the kings of rock and roll, not me. And so he upheld that to the bitter end.
Right.
And
I remember in the early days they didn't want to play Elvis because they said he sounded too black to put him on the radio. But you think about the power, the charisma that he had. I have to tell you, I got cheap tickets to see Elvis just happenstance. I think it was 1975. And when I looked at the audience, it was just as many men screaming and crying for Elvis as there were women. It was like men weren't jealous if their girlfriends were in love with Elvis because they were too. Okay, so you look at somebody that has that kind of power, that kind of charisma. And of course, the government is going to feel threatened, just as they did with John Lennon.
Right. That's why I showed the FBI memos that started as early as I think it was. I have a memo in there from 55 or 56. FBI file started them very early.
And I mean, listen, I just found out they had an FBI file on George Carlin. I mean, that doesn't
that makes
surprise
sense.
me. Do you know what I mean? It really doesn't surprise me that much, but people really have no idea of how the government manipulates all of us and how they flooded our country with drugs. We look at the war on drugs, which obviously is a war on us, not a war on drugs. But reading your book to see how they specifically target people, specifically get them addicted to control them. And then if they, start waking up, they make sure those people will never wake up by, taking them out one way or the other. And it's really sickening. I'm sure you've seen that film, The U.S. versus John Lennon.
Sure.
And look at the threat John Lennon was to Richard Nixon.
And that is a good film. It just didn't get into the whole history of Mark David Chapman that the good biographers get into, like the lawyer Fenton Bressler, who was also a London Daily newspaper crime reporter, and so he did that 7-year investigation of Lennon's death and found that he, you know, what all the evidence, he believed that the CIA was behind hypnotizing and using drugs to get Mark David Chapman to do what he did. And
that the same thing Sirhan's been saying for years?
Yeah.
You know, even Jared Lautner supposedly said the same thing when he went on the shooting range in Tucson, that he was mind controlled.
Right.
You know, it just seems so easy. You know, I forget the name of that movie. I think Denzel Washington redid it. About being, you know, mind controlled and being an asset.
Trained candidate.
There you go. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Now, if my memory serves me right, Frank Sinatra was in the original one. And after Kennedy was assassinated, they pulled that movie. That movie wasn't shown for quite a while, like the other movie, Executive Action, because it was too close to the truth. John, we're going to take a short break. When we get back, I'm going to come to something that I see you've been getting some controversy on Facebook. I follow everybody.
Sure.
And that's going to be on the death of Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love, who everybody still thinks is a sweet innocent. Well, after reading your book, that thought's out of my mind. So stay with us. John and I will be right back.
She's been called Paula Revere, the mother of the internet and even a legend. The mouth that roars, roars all truth without any input from corporate, religious, or political affiliations. Rhea's in it just like you are. Often imitated but never duplicated. Commercial-free talk providing a real education in a world filled with lies, cover-ups, and propaganda. Subscribe now and encourage your friends to do the same. Feel good about supporting real media that supports you and all life on this planet. Pick a subscription of your choice and get started on the journey down the rabbit hole. If you are financially challenged or a senior on a limited income, please send an email to maria@maria.net and she will work something out for you. There's never been a more dangerous or exciting time to be alive. Education is a necessity now. Stay informed. Subscribe today at www.meria.net.
Okay, welcome back. I'm speaking with John Potash, P-O-T-A-S-H, and that's his website too, johnpotash.com, the author of Drugs as Weapons Against Us. Everybody in this country needs to read this book. Now, John, it could be because, A, I didn't really care for new music because, you know, I'm sure I have a few years on you. I was never that attracted to Kurt Cobain or that type of music, okay? I'm a 60s kid at heart. It's never going to change. It's all I have on my iPod. But one thing I know is when I got a first look at Courtney Love, I knew everything about her I needed to know, okay? And even though you're not aware of it, I noticed that you were getting really attacked on social media and people defending Courtney Love and still believing the official story of Kurt Cobain's death. Now, I want to say, after reading the book, and I defended you on a lot of those posts, all I kept writing was, read the book. If indeed she didn't have him killed, which it sure looks like she did, at the very least, she was very much involved in the cover-up of his death, the same as Hillary Clinton was with one of her lovers that died in the White House and moving that body out of the White House. I think it was Vince Foster.
I haven't heard about that, but
well, that's another juicy little story. You can read about it in Roger Stone's book on the Clintons.
Good.
You know, listen, we've grown up in an America where everything is a cover up. Okay, everything from 9/11 was a cover up. The Kennedy assassination cover up. You know, Vince Foster, the string of murders that the Clintons left behind and cover up.
I talk about the Clintons' connection to the Contra crack connection with, you know, Bush Sr. and what he ran,
right?
Getting the cheap cocaine from the Contras in Nicaragua fighting,
Nicaraguan
I
was surprised to see you talk about Cord Meyer in your book because his wife Mary Meyer was a longtime lover of John Kennedy and she was murdered and her murder was covered up.
Yeah, sure. I think I mentioned it, but I don't think I got into it because it's just such a big topic.
I know, but when I saw Cord Meyer, I went right back to that book because I interviewed that author too. Kurt Cobain, he was a very popular young man, obviously very talented. also targeted, and his wife, Courtney Love, surely it didn't seem to me there was any love lost between the two of them at the time he died.
Yeah. Well, you know, people think that when I attack Courtney, I'm attacking women and women musicians in general. But what they have to understand is that Courtney attacked women musicians up a storm. Mm-hmm. Her breakthrough album, Live Through This, you know, Hole's breakthrough album, was a lot of critics said it. Kristen Pfaff is the one that broke that album, you know, made that album fantastic. Kristen Pfaff was a bass player who was hired, you know, was given tons of money to leave her band Janitor Joe to join Hole, and Kristen Pfaff ended up dead soon after Kurt Cobain ended up dead. And the best evidence says that Eric Erlandson, who was also in Hole, and Courtney Love had something to do with that death. Now, when I say they had something to do with that death, I am basically saying that U.S. intelligence had something to do with Kristen Pfaff's death, because the whole book is about the CIA's murderous targeting of these, you know, great activists and great musician activists. Mm-hmm. And so Courtney Love's life, as crazy as it may sound, appears to fit the pattern of MKUltra's project. It was like a sub-project called Project Monarch, which used hypnosis and drugs to manipulate people and get them to do, you know, basically to start with this physical and sexual abuse at an early age that caused dissociative identity disorder, which used to be mm-hmm. called multiple personality disorder, and then have trigger mechanisms to cause them to do their bidding, basically. So you have, you know, without, sorry, I don't have time to get into all the details of that, but basically my sources are Courtney Love's biological mother, Courtney Love's own biographies, and, you know, testing, you know, what she's told writers about her history, interviewing Hank Harrison for hours. Hank Harrison was her biological father, and getting all his sources. And, you know, and that's what appears to have happened to her. And Harrison, you know, praised my book in a big way, saying he didn't even realize, you know, how deep it went with her, because he lost custody of her when she was about 4 or 5 years old because of Courtney Love's mother. Linda Carroll was adopted by this very wealthy Bausch and Lomb and gold and mine magnates, and she was abused at an early age by her drunken father. Mm-hmm. And then when they went for custody of Courtney, the maternal grandparents, paid off Hank Harrison's lawyer to throw the case, and so Hank Harrison lost custody of Courtney for years until she wrote him from an institution and said, can you please get me out of here? You know, my mom's abandoned me completely. She's off in New Zealand. And here I am, and my doctors and therapists have been having sex with me since I was 3 years old, and they've been giving me all these psychohypnotic drugs. Right. And she named the drugs, Tuanols and Secanols, mm-hmm. and those are MKUltra drugs used for hypnosis and to turn, you know, programming, with what we call programming, what Project Monarch does with drugs and hypnosis to get people like Mark David Chapman to do what they did, to get people like Sirhan Sirhan to do what right. he did with RFK. And, you know, apparently what happened with Courtney Love is she was a heroin addict and prostitute at around 15 or 16 years old, according to Hank Harrison. So when he got her out of this institution, he didn't realize he was dealing with a woman was like acting like a monster. You know, she was already prostituting and using drugs up a storm, and he couldn't take all the needles lying around his house when she's still a teenager, and he had to kick her out. Mm-hmm. And she's, you know, he actually, you know, found out that she was actually prostituting to really top people in the San Francisco area, like the David Packard, former Assistant Secretary of Defense, David Packard of Hewlett Packard fame, mm-hmm. people like that. And then he goes off to do research in Ireland for a new book. He was a writer, you know, he's former one-time manager of the Grateful Dead and for 6 months, but then became a writer and advisor to them. But she goes and visits him in Ireland, and he introduces her to somebody who kind of befriended him, and didn't realize years later that guy who he introduced to her said he was a CIA undercover agent, and his brother was also. And they traveled with Courtney Love for weeks, like 6-8 weeks. And he ends up, and Courtney Love's about 16 years old, and she brings 1,000 hits of acid with her over to Ireland and then over to the London music scene. And then she's turned 17, and she's getting, distributing acid like candy all over the London music, I mean, the English music scene. I think it was Liverpool. And she's wrecking havoc. She's having sex with everybody, at, you know, and including the Pogues drummer. The Pogues are a top Irish band. And almost causes the breakup of the band and the divorce of the drummer and his wife. And, you know, it's, of course, it's the Pogues drummer's fault also. But she is just wrecking havoc. And she does this on the Portland music scene. She does this in Los Angeles music scene. That seems to be her mission. Mm-hmm. As bring tons of drugs, and where she gets them all, who knows, but I argue it's U.S. intelligence, because at first the CIA agent was traveling with her to these scenes, and then she's doing it on her own, and then she gets married to a guy, a top punk musician in Los Angeles, and he says he thought he was marrying a punk feminist, and it turns out he's marrying a right-wing Phyllis Diller, who, you know, who says she slept with army generals in Alaska. She was still prostituting herself. She was also, you know, in her own words, you know, in her own biography, saying she was working for the Asian mafia and prostituting to the Asian mafia when she was still a teenager. So here she is. She's married to this guy, and this guy's scared to death of his wife, and he finally divorces her, but not before she has thugs beat him up when he doesn't do what she says. Hmm. And so then she moves on to Kurt Cobain and enters his life when his album's already rising, you know, starting to rise up the music charts. Gets pregnant with him. He does his due diligence and decides he's going to propose to her after she gets pregnant, but he has her sign a prenuptial agreement. And then when he can't take her anymore because she's just out of her mind and sleeping with so many different other people, he files for divorce and he tells his lawyer, and this is on tape. They have Rosemary Carroll, who was both their lawyers, on tape saying, he said, you know, get me the divorce lawyer, and she said, get me the most vicious divorce lawyer you can possibly find. And he was cutting her out of his will also, and then he, of course, ends up dead. Now, this would all be fine that it was just, you know, Courtney Love manipulating things, but all the cover-up, all the media cover-up of how he died, there's, if you see the film Soaked in Bleach, they have interviews of the top pathologists in the country, Cyril Wecht, saying this is just unbelievable how they did this, you know, investigation of his death. You do not pronounce someone as a suicide the same day you find his body. This is just right. Uncalled for. And he also, Cyril Wecht also says it's virtually impossible for someone to have carried out what Kurt Cobain did with the amount of heroin in his system. He says it's not impossible, but it's really, he's never seen, and he's in, you know, in his 80s right now, Cyril Wecht. And he says in his, you know, 60 years of practicing, he's never seen somebody shoot up a load of heroin and then proceed to kill themselves. That does not happen, he says. So these are the kinds that, this is just some of the mountain of evidence that Courtney Love helped orchestrate the murder of Kurt Cobain on behalf of U.S. intelligence and the oligarchs. And the evidence points to the fact that she got him using heroin regularly to promote heroin, and then when he started sobering up, and that's the evidence of that is in Rome, when he had a coma in Rome, they found that there was no illicit substances in his body. There was only Courtney Love's prescription sleep medication, which she had gotten in London, roofies, you know, Rohypnol, which is actually legal sleep medication in London. And so she apparently slipped him loads of roofies in his drink, and he went into a coma. But he did not have any heroin in his system. He didn't even have any weed in his system or any other illicit drugs in his system. And that's what all reports say, that he'd actually sobered up for a long time before he died. And it also, they also say that one of the reasons is because he solved a massive stomach problem he had a year before he died. So.
Yep. So again, I've got to tell people, read the book. Before you start defending anybody, read the book, because it's pretty in-depth. I think at one point I read something where she offered somebody $50,000 to kill her husband.
Right, right. And so, that's on tape in award-winning filmmaker Nick Broomfield's film, Kurt and Courtney. This guy, Eldon Hoke, also called El Duce, he was a musician who, you know, is a bit out there of a musician, but he passed polygraph test twice from the leading polygrapher in the country. And this is on a TV show. I think it was Hard Copy. And he passed twice with flying colors, that saying that Courtney Love offered me $50,000 to blow Kurt Cobain's head off. And so he says it on tape for Nick Broomfield. Broomfield puts in his movie, but within about 7 days of saying that for Broomfield on camera, he ends up dying mysteriously.
Yeah, what a surprise. And even more surprising is after all the information you provide in the book, she was never charged with anything.
Yeah. I mean, she's got incredible protection. She punched Kathleen Hanna in the face at the Lollapalooza concert, knocked her cold out, knocked her to the floor cold, and in front of Sonic Youth's lead singers, the husband and wife team, Thurston Moore and Kim Gordon, and they were just disgusted. They were like, they couldn't believe it. They threatened to... They were the headliners of the Lollapalooza tour that year. Kathleen Hanna was playing, and Love was playing with Hole for that tour. But they just threatened to quit the whole tour unless Lollapalooza kicked Courtney Love off the tour. And they threatened every stop, but their lawyer said, you just can't do this because it's going to cost millions and millions of dollars for you. But they were just so disgusted, no one could believe it. And this is her common pattern. She punched a number of women in the face and is just brutal and violent, and nothing comes of it. She gets a slap on the wrist at best. It usually doesn't even go to court,
Right. Well, that's another sign. You have to look at that and say, how come? Why is it that she didn't get charged with anything?
She's completely protected. Yeah.
Right. But her story is so similar to a lot of these people that are controlled since they're children, even in the pedophile, which, of course, is a topic for a whole nother 100 shows. But if you look at these pedophile rings, it's very typical what they do to these children. It's like they break their soul at a young age. They usually do get them involved in prostitution and drugs and a whole lot of mind control. You hear so much about that, especially now with a lot of that being exposed worldwide, which is about time. So I thought of Michelle Phillips when I was reading about Courtney Love's background. And, you got to feel sorry for them. But at a certain point, they become very scary. They become very scary human beings, too.
I know. I mean, it's hard. It's like they're both, they're both victims and monsters at the same time. So it's very hard to know how they feel about them. But, if people have a hard time understanding this, understand that there's a counselor took two of her clients or patients, people she was counseling, who were both MKUltra victims of drugs and hypnosis from an early age. They were both about the same age as Courtney Love, and they testified at federal hearings, and you can find this on YouTube. You can see it easily. And they testified exactly how it all worked, exactly how they were kind of controlled, they were manipulated with sex abuse and physical abuse and the drugs to become assassins, believe it or not, for the CIA. And so you can hear their story. And when this counselor said, when she gave notice to the counseling community that she was going to do this, testify with her clients, she said within a week, 40 other counselors called her and said, we have clients or patients just like this that we counsel. And, I hope you speak for all of them too, and so, this was in federal hearings that actually Bill Clinton allowed to happen. Good for him, even though he's involved in so much corruption, it was good that he allowed these hearings to happen. Now, most people didn't find out about this testimony, but you can find it on YouTube. One of the people, I think the counselor's name was Claudia Mullins, but you can look that up and find this testimony. So, people hear mind control sometimes, they think, oh, that's crazy, but it's been documented in a lot of ways. It's in CIA documents, other researchers and counselors have found these documents. It's it's not hard to find out about. It's just the real details are hard to get all of, exactly who went through it, like you say.
Right. Well, then I saw an old familiar name. I almost fell off my chair reading it. When you started talking about Alan Freed, okay, I don't know how old you are, John. I'm taking a wild guess. You're a lot younger than me. You're 50? Okay.
50.
So when I was a kid, I was probably, we'll say 12. So we're looking at 1962. the biggest shows you could go to were Alan Freed's rock and roll shows.
Yeah.
Okay, and you'd go to the Fox Theater in Brooklyn. It cost you 50 cents. Every one of every great black group that ever existed was performing at the same time. All us kids would be dancing in the aisles, dancing in the streets. Everybody loved Alan Freed. It was the only radio station we ever listened to. And then they set up Alan Freed. No one's ever talked about it. At least I've never seen it written anywhere. But I knew he was set up too when it was happening, even though I was a kid. And they pretty much took him out of business. And then I read about that in your book, and I said, wow, even Alan Freed is in the mix in here. He didn't leave too much out.
Yeah, he broke black music into white mainstream audiences and had the most integrated shows, you know, the first time of you know, 50s and 60s in terms of, like, big mainstream integrated audiences. And so they first used him to kind of promote, you know, some of these stations, and then they did away with him, basically. But they, sadly enough, while they were using him, they, you know, to promote these big stations, they kind of brought in that menu, that rock and roll menu in the top 10 kind of idea in order to control programming. Just too bad.
Right. But I think if man, that was such a long time ago. I think the story that they took him out on was probably having sex with young girls.
No, it was actually the payola scandal.
Oh, was that? Okay.
Yeah.
It's hard to remember.
Which was legal at that time. It wasn't even illegal, according to the author of a good book on the subject called Hitman. But they still, you know, instead of getting the people who had all the big money throwing the money out to DJs, they take out the little, you know, the smaller DJ. And so, you know, but none of the big men who were doing all the, you know, payoffs, the payola, none of them got in trouble.
Right.
And it wasn't even illegal then, but they made it illegal after the fact and took him, you know, ruined his career. And what he did is he broke black music to mainstream, you know, white audiences.
Well, yeah, and that. I mean, I saw Alan Freed in person several times because there was never a time he was having a show that I was going to miss it. I mean, we're talking about he had everybody from the Temptations to Chuck Berry on the same stage. Who would want to miss that?
Right.
But it was hard to tell if he was white or black, you know, and he had a Jewish name. So it made it even more confusing. But to kids in Brooklyn, we didn't care. You know, we didn't see color. You know what I mean? You talk about so much in this book. Really, I don't know anybody that will be bored with this book. And you start, of course, with the history of drug importation and wars for drug around the world since the 1700s, maybe sooner. But you talk about the Grateful Dead. Now, I was never a fan of that music either. And after reading your book, I said, wow, I guess it was a good thing I wasn't. It looks to me that the Grateful Dead was willfully working with the government.
Yeah, I can't say for sure. A lot of people do think they were willfully working with the government. I just can't say for sure. What I can say, though, is I was duped. You know, I mean, I like the Grateful Dead. I can't even say I mean, I still kind of like their music, but I can't really stomach it well, knowing that it helped dose, you know, loads of people with LSD for the first time. And so it's clear, though, if they weren't working for the with the government, then they were handled and manipulated by people like Augustus Owsley Stanley III. Who, you know, all evidence supports were working with the government. He was probably the first biggest acid dealer, and his family are the patricians of Kentucky. I mean, a whole county is named Owsley County in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
That's how wealthy they are. You know, blue bloods of our country. And so he was super conservative, according to Hank Harrison, who was one of their first managers. And Hank Harrison said he was very, you know, leftist and radical himself, Hank Harrison was. So he was always battling with Owsley over control over the Dead. And, of course, he lost. He only really managed them for 6 months before Owsley really took everything over because he had so much money, so much power. And then you know, the Dead start these acid tests. And at these acid tests are top MKUltra agents, including, you know, a top MKUltra scientist named Gittinger. And Gittinger said he, you know, in a legal deposition, said he was there with two other MKUltra scientists at several of the acid tests, even though they work in Washington, D.C. They're out there in the San Francisco area and watching people, you know, get dosed with LSD. And some of those acid tests came like right after the LA, you know, the Watts riots, for example, the biggest, civil rights riot in the country. And so, and some people call these race riots rebellions. They're really race rebellions, and have whatever you want to call them. Right after, while things are still smoldering in Watts, all of a sudden they have this big, this big musical extravaganza of the Grateful Dead playing music, and these vats, these like trash cans full of Hawaiian punch that's dosed with tons of LSD, and loads of black people in the neighborhood who came to hear the music and dance and get sweaty and went to get something to drink, got LSD against their will, not knowing it was dosed. Now, some people may have known that punch was dosed, but a lot of people didn't. Mm-hmm. That's what they call electric Kool-Aid, and there was a book, Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, written about it. But it was very sinister. And there were loads of different agents, even besides the MKUltra top psychologist, John Gittinger, and his fellow scientists. There were, other federal agents there, too. So it was really an ugly situation.
Yeah, I look at that. I was reading how many millions of doses of LSD are here and there, given away free, at Woodstock, here, there. And I'm like, who can afford, and who would in their right mind, would give away that kind of drugs? And who could afford it except the government?
Right. And then you find that the top LSD dealer in the world, you got Ronald Hedley Stark, an Italian governmental commission does a study of Ronald Stark, and they find that he'd been working with the Secret Services since 1960. And Italian judge writes in his report that Ron Stark showed numerous amounts of evidence to support that he worked for U.S. intelligence, and ended up letting him go. Now, the first judge that was presiding over that case got killed. So, the next judge was a little smarter about it and saved his own life and just said he wrote about it, but I'm letting him free and I'm going to spare my own life. But, an Italian governmental report on it all just went into the details about what Stark was. Stark ran LSD laboratories on several continents. It's incredible.
I know, and it just seems like these people were free to do it. But if they had a top star who got busted with a little pot, they put him in jail for months and months.
Yeah.
So I guess it wasn't the government's drug of choice. Right. I found it pretty fascinating how they secretly dosed some of the Beatles and some of the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, and that's when I mentioned before that, A.E. Hotchner documented how Robert Lashbrook, the deputy director of MKUltra, when he brought over the tons of acid, tons of LSD, and tons of money and agents over to London in 1965, it was soon after that this dentist, George Harrison's dentist, invited John Lennon, George Harrison, and their partners over for dinner. And they were going to leave, go to see a friend's band. And they said, don't go yet. We got this great coffee and great dessert for you. So they stayed a little extra and had the coffee. And then when they were about to go again, they said, no, you can't leave now. You just had LSD. And George Harrison said, what's LSD? He'd never even heard of it before. And John Lennon was furious. He said, it's a drug. They drugged us. And so that was the first way they did LSD, was being dosed by George Harrison's dentist. So how in the world would a dentist do that and get away with it? Well, why would he do it unless he was working for U.S. intelligence and knew he was immune from any kind of prosecution from these wealthy musicians?
Exactly. Yeah, so, and I remember, at that time, John, there was such a paranoia in going to clubs in New York, because that's where I grew up. Where people would say, don't leave your drink. If you have to go to the bathroom, somebody might slip some LSD in your drink. I mean, it created a paranoia to just go out and want to have a good night dancing and having a few drinks.
Wow, yeah, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, and until this day, I never leave a drink on the bar. I mean, it was pounded into us.
Yeah.
I never did LSD or, acid or any of that, but I know people that did do acid at Woodstock. And as full-grown adults, they said that they felt they were never normal again after that.
Yeah, that's how I felt. William S. Burroughs says it makes people less competent. And I did about a half dozen hits my first year of college, and my grades dropped drastically. And it took a year or more for them to, rise up again. But, I lost abilities I never regained. And so that just, I didn't know what to think of it. I just, I just thought, well, this is the way it is. But then it just sparked my thoughts, well, maybe there's something more to all this. Maybe it's not incidental that, this causes this. And so when some of these musicians are kind of getting sidetracked by some of these drugs. And that's what got me partly, into the field of counseling and partly into, researching this book. But at first I was in denial. I still kind of, my senior year of college, despite what happened my freshman year, kind of glorified acid because I still kind of tied it to left-wing activism and the anti-war movement, not realizing that,
that it was implanted in it.
Yeah, not realizing it was the plan of CIA to do that. And that was, to try and romanticize these drugs and then hurt people's minds so they can't, do their activism as competently.
Basically. Exactly. I was probably in my early 20s when Timothy Leary was with his, I don't know how the expression exactly went, turn on,
tune out. Turn in, drop out.
Right.
You could drop out of activism,
And that's exactly what it meant. And I knew that even at that age, okay, and I certainly wasn't into the things I'm doing now. I was doing what normal 20-year-olds did in those times. I was getting married, thinking about having a baby. But I was reading the papers and I was like, why would anybody want to do this? And I just knew to separate myself from that. And I always kept myself separate from that, which of course, cost me some friends because they thought I was just trying to be holier than thou with them, but it just didn't feel right.
Yeah, good for you. Good intuition because, Leary's mansion that was given to him, the estate, the Millbrook estate was given to him by William Mellon Hitchcock, and the Mellon family owned Gulf Oil, Mellon Bank, Carnegie Mellon University and all that stuff. And they were incredibly wealthy, and they basically, William Mellon Hitchcock and Peggy Hitchcock, funded Leary's group of the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, which was part of which Ron Stark, that CIA agent who ran this LSD laboratories on different continents. He was part of them. And so here in Millbrook, the Millbrook Estate, just above New York City, he's got loads of MKUltra scientists there, stationed there. He's inviting tons of people, including activists and entertainers, to this party, and they're trying different drugs on all these left-wing entertainers.
Unbelievable.
And even influence someone to try get Groucho Marx to try LSD.
I know, that. I saw that in the book. I said, well, Groucho Marx, I mean, he was one of a kind. So,
It's just very sad how they convinced, Lenny Bruce, all these great entertainers to get on, try LSD.
Right. And I mean,
they may not hurt their competence. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. John, I have to tell you, this was a very informative hour, and I love your book, and I'm going to continue to refer people to it for sure. So I want to thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Maria. It's real good talking to you again.
Same here. Let's hope it's another 10 years before we talk to each other again.
Definitely.
All right. Take care, John.
You too, Maria.
Thanks. John Potash, check out the book, Drugs as Weapons Against Us. It's an eye-opener. Believe me, people, you're going to love it. Love it and hate it, because of the info, but better to know than not know. And that's always been my motto. And I got to tell you, whoever's been looking out for me my whole life and my intuition has saved me a whole lot of grief. And when I read things like this, 40, 50 years later, I'm like, phew, all right. Anyway, thanks for supporting the show. I'll see you guys tomorrow when I'm back with news of Planet of the Apes.
Thank you for listening and supporting The Maria Show. Tell others what you learned today. Knowledge becomes wisdom only when it's shared. Encourage others to subscribe today. www.maria.net. Often imitated, never duplicated. A world of information all in one place. www.maria.net. Always ahead of the curve. Always on your side. Get active or get radioactive. Subscribe today.